welcome to the ABCA's podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Brownlee. If you run a baseball facility, Swift is the only piece of software you need to manage and grow your business. From scheduling and payments to memberships and retail, Swift takes care of it all. Your coaches can use the app to manage their schedule on the go, and your customers have a sleek and fast way to book online. Lessons, rentals, camps, packages, and more, all in one spot. That's why hundreds of the best baseball facilities across the country rely on Swift. And now with their upcoming AI front desk, you can literally put your business on autopilot. Get started in minutes at runswiftapp.com/ABCA. That's runswiftapp.com/ABCA. Spend less time behind the screen and more time on the field. This episode is sponsored by Netting Pros. Netting professionals are improving programs one facility at a time. Netting Professionals specializes in the design, fabrication, and installation of custom netting for backstops, batting cages, dugouts, BP screens, and ball carts. They also design and install digital graphic wall padding, windscreen, turf, turf protectors, dugout benches, dugout cubbies, and more. Netting Professionals is an official partner of the ABCA and continues to provide quality products and services to many high school, college, and professional fields, facilities, and stadiums throughout the country. Netting professionals are improving programs one facility at a time. Contact them today at 844-620-2707 or info@nettingpros.com. Visit them online at www.nettingpros.com or check out Netting Pros on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn for all their latest products and projects. Make sure to let CEO Will Miner know that the ABCA sent you. Now on to the podcast. Brian Johnson is the founder of the social training platform Heroic, a public benefit corporation focused on helping people flourish by embodying their best, most heroic self through integrating ancient wisdom and modern science, with a goal for 51% of humanity to flourish by 2051. Johnson is the author of the book Arete and has worked with the Navy SEALs, Notre Dame football, and the European Ryder Cup team. Johnson has a philosophy background and is known for distilling down complex ideas into practical tools, promoting themes of self-mastery, wisdom, courage, love, and helping individuals activate their potential. Johnson will be presenting on the main stage of the upcoming ABCA convention in Columbus, Ohio. In this episode, we cover a wide array of peak performance topics that will help everyone become the best version of themselves. Johnson also just released Philosopher Notes, which he personally, not AI-generated, condensed over 700 books to save readers time, allowing leaders to focus on 8 domains of wisdom, which are energy, habits, stoicism, mental toughness, purpose, productivity, relationships, and leadership. ABCA podcast listeners can sign up at philosophersnotes.com/ABCA. Let's welcome Brian Johnson to the podcast.
Good to see you, man. How was your weekend?
It was good, low key. Just getting ready for the convention.
You guys are busy, huh?
I still use a yellow legal pad. Like when I get in the weeds, I still use a yellow legal
pad.
Dude,
I'm like you. Well, I don't go. I just use a blank piece of paper. That's just my thing. But I was a yellow legal pad guy for quite a while.
That's what I wrote all my college papers off of. Like just my handwritten notes before I started typing. It's always just, it's worked that way. Coaching, I still have like yellow notepads from when I was coaching.
Wow.
I don't usually go back and look at them, but it's just, you know what it's kind of like good reminders of, even when you think like you're behind or you can't get stuff done, it's like just good reminders of like, okay, you've done a lot of this in the past and you might feel like you're drinking from the fire hose right now, but you're going to be fine.
Yep, 100%. It's exactly how I prepare for all my classes and keynotes and whatnot. It gets into keynote eventually, but just that visceral feeling of writing something down, I find to be like slows me down, gets me out of the buzz of technology, you know, and I can actually think and do good work.
All right, here with Brian Johnson, author of Airte, founder of Heroic, the Heroic app, but soon to be releasing the Philosopher's Notes, but speaking on the main stage this year in Columbus in a couple weeks. So, Brian, thanks for jumping on with me.
Brian, thrilled to be here, man. Looking forward to our chat.
Hey, when did you decide to move to Austin?
Great question. Wife decided she wanted 5.5 years ago. She wanted less house, more land. Was from California. We're like, all right, where do we want to go? You know, it's right before everybody moved to Austin, you know, pre-diaspora. I took the last flight before COVID shut everything down, put an offer on the place we're in, and we've loved it here.
I'm an avid Tim Ferriss listener, and it seemed like he kind of started the train along with others to get people.
Ryan Holiday and him were the two that were like, you know, if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for us. Let's go.
Hey, and I have seen the Phil Stutz documentary. And I know you mentioned him quite a bit. Is he a mentor? Do you consider him a mentor to you?
Dude, I consider him I've been blessed to have a number of human beings, mostly men, who have really impacted my life. Number one, I mean, I've done almost 500 one-on-one coaching sessions with him. If I don't have the most all time, then I'd like to meet the guy that's got to have more, you know, but he's just, he's kind of become my spiritual father, you know, and just has says the things that I've been studying, ancient wisdom, modern science, in a really practical, grounded, yet spiritual way that has really resonated with me. And he's just a wonderful human being that's really impacted me deeply.
You're abnormal in that way when you say I have men as mentors. I think it's really hard for some men to be able to connect with other men and find mentors. Do you have any tips for that?
You know, it's been hard for me. I mean, I get goosebumps saying that. Like, I think that's right. I think that particularly men of our level of ambition, you know, who are really committed and tend to be in a position of leadership, and we're the coaches, right, who are coaching others. So for me, it's been a struggle. I know I've been blessed to have, you know, some investors and board members of mine who drove me as an entrepreneur, and then some, kind of philosophical guides. But really there's two that were the most impactful, and I feel blessed to have found them. One guy I worked with for 3-4 years, Steve Chandler, who's a great, coach. He's kind of like a recovered alcoholic. My dad was an alcoholic. So it was like almost like the healthy version of my dad, who never moved through that, you know. It was great. And then took a little gap and then worked with Phil. But for me to kind of submit myself in that relationship requires someone that's performing at a very, very high level. And at the risk of being immodest, like, I need someone who's demonstrated a level of mastery on what I want to master with them that's going to be, you know, X steps ahead of me. So it's been a challenge. But then what I found was when I did find resonance, I went all in. So when I read Phil's book, I bought it for everybody. I mean, I literally sent, I don't know, dozens of copies. And then I interviewed him and his co-author. And I literally knew I wanted to work with him. I didn't know which one. And I said, it's like choosing between Obi-Wan Kenobi and Yoda. You know, like, you got Phil who created it, then his co-author. I'm like, you kind of have to go with Yoda. In that, you got the choice. You got to go with Yoda, right? Anyway, then I go all in. So there's a very high bar for me to trust someone enough to put them into that role in my life. Then I'm going to maintain my autonomy, of course. But then when we get clarity, like, I do what we agree is right. And then it's about action. And then I want to make them proud. I mean, there's a true, like, for me, a good mentor-mentee relationship, whether I'm the mentor and coaching someone or I'm being coached, I want to be the best demonstration of their philosophy ever. Like, that's the standard that I set myself to. And then I found with me and Phil and Steve before, like, the relationship's really, really exciting. Like, there's a level of coherence and integration where you're doing some really good work together and showing up excited to go next level, you know?
And, you know, one of my favorite things is the way that people talk about you when you're not in that room. And a lot of people feel that way about you. How you feel about those two guys, a lot of people do feel that way about you.
Oh, dude, I appreciate that. And then my commitment on that side is, it's both ways. I want to be worthy. You know, for me, the Navy SEALs got it right. You know, you go through their training and BUDS and Hell Week, and then when you graduate, they give you the card. And I have two of them that I got from SEALs that I've been blessed to work with that you got to earn your trident today. Congratulations. You just went through the hardest training ever. Today's the day. Earn your trident again. So for me, I just want to show up, do the work, be worthy to be in a position of hopefully I've got, you know, a step or two in the domain that I've chosen to master: ancient wisdom, modern science, meaning, purpose, excellence, peak performance, et cetera. So that means a lot to me. And I know that's how we connected, you know, through a couple of one of my oldest friends and new friend in Brian. And yeah, man, just doing the work. But to me, that's what it's all about. And you know, I'm preaching to the Pope right now, you know, but it's process, and look up and hopefully you're worthy of playing a role in different people's lives.
And you've had a ton of great experiences, but how do you take all of that, all that you've done, and whittle that down to actually writing a book?
Yeah, I mean, that book, there were two books I could have written. I could have written the book, which was like the distillation of everything I've done. That book is basically like a best of. So Arete is, you know, it's 451, which is related to the 451 degrees Fahrenheit you need to ignite a fire. It's 451 little micro ideas, distinctions to help you close the gap, be your best self. So that's basically a best of like a decade's worth of writing, you know? So it was more of an editorial process and a curation than it was like a start from page one and get to the end of the book kind of thing. So that, you know, that book took me 25 years to write, you know, and then just put it together.
I think it does remind me of like Tribe of Mentors and Tools of Titans. I like it because you can just pick it up at anywhere and start reading it. You don't have to go from start to finish. I like that you can just flip open a page and fire away and get something out of it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And then for me, and Phil Stutz says this, the only good philosophy is one that ends in action. So it has to end in action. It has to end in action. It has to end in action. Like theory to practice to mastery, that's my obsession. So in two pages, can I give you a distinction? And then can I get you in action and make you a little bit better than you were before you read that, you know?
And I like that you talk about anti-fragility. I don't think society is talking about that enough now.
I did an interview last week with a guy named Ben Bergeron, who is one of the world's best CrossFit coaches. Yeah.
I have his book.
Dude,
one of my favorite books.
Okay, so my book is called Arete, which of course is the Greek word for excellence. His book is called Chasing Excellence.
So
we're like soul brothers, you know? It's like, all right, Chasing Arete. The interview that we did together, that's all we talked about was forging anti-fragility. And this is, I mean, I tattooed my body with anti-fragile confidence. When I have the opportunity to work with elite performers like, you know, Naval Special Warfare, Special Operators, and Notre Dame football, Luke Donald, we talked about, you and I, you know, that's literally what they bring me in to talk about. And no one's talking about it. I mean, you've got Nassim Taleb, who coined the word anti-fragile, which we can define. And then you've got Jonathan Haidt, who I really respect. Other than those two guys, I don't know anybody else other than me that's really trying to bring this into our culture. And there's no more powerful idea. Other ideas are tied for first. Nothing is more powerful than getting great at forging anti-fragility.
That's a little bit of a Jocko Willink,
by the way.
Little Jocko Willink thing.
Yeah.
Little Jocko Willink, they're part of it too, about taking extreme responsibility for anything that happens to you.
No, 100%. I mean, good.
Extreme ownership.
He doesn't use that word. There's something about the word of going from fragile to resilient to anti-fragile. So I'll frame it up real quick. Is that cool?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So if you're fragile, when life hits you, you break. If you're resilient, which is what everyone thinks you want to be, and of course it's better than being fragile, then you can get hit and you bounce back faster. But Nassim Taleb said, what's the opposite of fragility? It's not resilience. Resilience is just not being totally fragile, but what's the opposite of it? What would happen if when life hits you, you get stronger? That's anti-fragility. And the metaphor he uses is the wind, life's challenges, extinguish a candle, fragile, but the same wind fuels a fire. So then he says, you want to be the fire and wish for the wind. It's like going to the gym. You want to go to the gym and lift real weights in order to get stronger. Yet most of us, when we face a challenge, whether it's at work, where we're all pretty good, or energy, health crisis, or relationship crisis, where most people have a little more challenges, you break and you complain, you know? But to bring that anti-fragile mindset of this is fuel, this is how I'm going to get stronger. And when I get hit, I double down on my protocol. You know, we take that off the bumper sticker and apply it to our lives right now. Everything changes.
How much of that with the SEALs is yes, applying the stress, but then also the recovery process of it?
Well, dude, a lot of it. But even it's the mindset shift. I mean, there's no more disciplined, anti-fragile, heroic human beings than Navy SEALs. And yet, you know, I'm invited in by the Naval Special Warfare Commander, two-star admiral, to talk to his top 50 commanders to forge anti-fragile confidence. Because even if you're, my joke was, I get up there and I'm like, guys, 90% of this stuff I'm going to tell you, I learned from you. Let's just be clear, right? Yeah. But it's easy for those of us, same question you asked in the beginning of the mentorship, you know, and that reminding ourselves of what we may get implicitly than making it explicit. So the problem becomes for those of us who are typically the coaches, the guides, et cetera, we forget that when life hits us, that nothing's wrong with us when we get a little wobbly, you know, that we need to remind ourselves that no, in those moments is when you need to, you know, double down, triple down, et cetera. But yeah, it's making the implicit explicit is my big thing. You know, this is common sense that needs to be common practice at the highest levels in whatever domain you need to excel at.
And then how do you distill all that down into the Heroic app? Because you could have went in a million different directions with that. Yeah, how do you distill all that down?
You know, same way you've done with what you do, right? It's just craft. And we were talking about, you know, you use your yellow legal pad. I got my, dude, I have cut down dozens of trees, you know, the amount of effort I've put in. But my job with Philosopher's Notes, which is what I've been doing the longest, is to just, I've been obsessed about what it is that makes truly great, exceptional people extraordinary. What is it, you know? And so, as you know, I've read everything I possibly could, ancient wisdom, modern science, distilled it. And then what I do in the app, what I do in the book, and what we do with the Philosopher's Notes, 7 objectives. So I've distilled all of ancient wisdom and modern science into 7 objectives. The second one is forge anti-fragile confidence. The first one is you got to know the ultimate game. So when I work with like Marcus Freeman at Notre Dame or Luke Donald, even with the Ryder Cup team, and the military guys, the first thing I say is the game you think you're playing isn't the most important game. Step back. The ultimate game is be the best version of you. Be the best version of you on and off the field, on and off the battlefield, on and off the course. If that version of you shows up, not just on the job, on the field, in the battlefield, but in home, you know, in your own life outside of that, then you have a chance of being your best self. But anyway, everything boils down to those 7 objectives. And then it's just craft. You know, I've just been grinding on this and obsessed about it. And, you know, frankly, really proud of how we've distilled it down. And we've scientifically proven the app, our coaching program, everything we've done is grounded in science and proven by science, which, you know, I'm proud of and excited about. And most importantly, it works. If you work it, key asterisks, you know, you got to do it, right?
How hard was that going in with dealing with golfers? Because they're so used to being individualized, but then with the Ryder Cup, it is really about your team.
Dude, those here, Luke Donald's a special human being. I mean, to be part of that, he reached out like a year and a half, right after he took the captaincy, he reached out. He's been following my work for a decade and reached out and said, hey, I want to talk to you about anti-fragility. I'm on the phone with him the next day. I literally flew out 2 days later and we're hanging out. And I said, look, you got to train. From now, and he was, but you got to train now. Americans are going to start training 3 weeks. They're going to pick the team. They're going to start thinking about it. So he flew me out to Scotland 15 months at the Scottish Open, 15 months before the Open. And dude, I've never been in a room full of more coachable human beings. And the reason why they're special, goosebumps, is they weren't playing just for themselves. They love the cup. I mean, and again, the Americans do too, but like there's a certain brotherhood that I felt there where their personal excellence was connected to something bigger than themselves. And of course the Americans have that too, but it's so deep in their culture. And it was really humbling to be part of that and to see Luke and dude, I mean, you know, he doesn't want me talking much about the individuals, but people, if I name them, do you know, on the European team, dude, the most coachable people I've ever worked. They're hungry, you know, and that's great performers are right. Dude, that was a lot of fun. I mean, they knew New York was going to be crazy, but that's anti-fragility. So the thing there was, the worse the crowd gets, the more committed you need to be to your protocol. So I fly out, I'm in New York and I'm watching the Ryder Cup. I'm in the elevator on Saturday night and the Americans I'm with are like, that I'm in the elevator with, I don't know them. They're almost crying, literally. They're like, dude, it's as if the worse we get, the better they play. And so I text Luke from the elevator. I'm like, dude, listen to this. It's a definition of anti-fragility. What I told him was, you got to be the fire and wish for the wind. New York's going to be crazy. So when they get crazy, what do? You flip the switch. You practice your protocol with even more vigilance and rigor. Your posture, your breathing, your mental focus has to be more dialed in than ever. Anyway, if you listen to his press conference that afternoon or that evening, which was 30, 60 minutes after we traded text, he's talking about anti-fragility. Literally, he says, yeah, the worse it got, the better we got. It's anti-fragility, let's go. But again, you got to take that off the bumper sticker. All of your coaches, it's why they're great, and why it's so fun to be in dialogue like this. And
a lot of similarities between golf and baseball from a mental toughness standpoint, because the amount of downtime there is between action in both of those sports.
Well, I'll tell you what, though, Marcus Freeman. So you go into the Notre Dame training facilities, and it's like 18 seconds, I think, is the average time of a play. So everywhere is like, 0.18. But what I told him was that isn't the most important part of the game. It's in between the plays. So in between the plays, what are you doing? And are you getting yourself back? So I think every activity that involves that level of peak performance, and again, any sport that you're going to bring in, it's the same thing. Are you training a recovery in those moments of brief rest and that physical posture, the breathing, the mental, all the obvious things that need to be done? But yeah, I think there's so many parallels with what you guys are doing on the field that translates. You just throw 8 more guys out there with you, right?
What did draw you into philosophy? Because you and I are kindred spirits with that. And that's why Dan Keller was like, you guys need to connect at some point. Because mine was, I lived in a small town in southern Indiana, and I felt like there was a lot more out there than maybe what I was surrounded by in my small little bubble in southern Indiana.
Yeah. Well, first and most importantly, shout out to Dan Keller. As we shared, the morning Dan Keller, former All-American UCLA baseball player who's really involved with your community, youth sports, et cetera. Wonderful human being. The night he was born, his brother, 2 years older, spent at my house. So Dan's one of my oldest friends and all that good stuff. Dude, but the short answer is suffering. My dad struggled with alcohol. His dad struggled with alcohol, killed himself. I had my own psychological challenges as a young man. And, my joke is I seem to have lost the genetic and the environmental lottery on that side of things, and having experienced that suffering and personally wanting to figure out how I can go from wanting to end my life, which is where I was 25 plus years ago, to creating a life. I figured a few things out, and we're all human. But I'm at this point. I was here, and I know what I did to go from here to there. So it's been an obsession, And I just feel like this is what I'm here to do. Is to take my own suffering and to channel it into tools that we have a lot of people that want it in their lives, man. Gives me tears in my eyes.
Numbers are still going up. I talk about it on the circuit. Numbers are still, we're over 50,000 2 years ago when the CDC numbers came out for suicide. We're over 50,000. And 76% of those are white males between like 15 and 55. So it's affecting everyone.
Everybody. I mean, and everybody, So then those of us who may be performing at a peak level, like under the hood, we've just got a lot of these unresolved challenges that it's just part of what makes us human, So wherever individuals are on the spectrum of their current performance, and everyone's different in different domains. Some people, it's like work's great, the relationships are tough, or health challenges. So anyway, it was my own suffering and just a real commitment to doing everything I could to play my role well. I'm a good Catholic boy at heart, and my mom told me it. 12 years old, grabbed me by the shoulders when I did something that upset her and shook me and looked me in the eye. God gave you gifts, you got to give them to the world. So I really feel called to help people see their potential, like you're the hero we've been waiting for. Wake up. Isn't a dress rehearsal. Let's go is kind of the ethos that drives me every day.
This is the hard part with social media, though, now is because you see everybody's best bolt. So I think as a high performing male, you may be struggling in some areas, but you're going to look and you'll see, well, they've got all the boxes checked off. And most people very rarely have all the boxes checked off.
Yeah, we can put that into the bucket of spend as little time as you can looking at that. And it's all, if I curse, nonsense, right? So it is what it is. But you know, comparison's never going to make us, you know, get where we want to get, you know. And then for me, it's less of that. But then in coaches, like when I work with the Naval Special Warfare guys, for example, I call them out, dude. Like it frustrates me that like coaches aren't in the best shape of anyone on the field. Marcus Freeman, when I first met him, I'm like, dude, he came on to Zoom, you know, and I'm like, dude, you're exactly what a football coach should look like. I don't understand. Baseball coaches are out of shape. Dude, that it's untenable. Like leadership 101, do what you say you're going to do, model the behaviors you want to see from your players. Like, and I share that in this context because the downstream effects of an out of shape coach are psychological. Physiology is driving your psychology. So if you're struggling in any way with any of those issues, and as a guy who knows what it's like to be struggling so desperately that I want to end my life, you solve that with your eating, your moving, and your sleeping. So getting yourself into the best physical shape of your life should be your number one job. You should be a disciplined athlete. Almost all these coaches that, you know, part of your community were elite athletes in their own regard, right? Or aspired to be. Why aren't you now? Why aren't you in the best shape of your life? And I literally say this to the Navy SEAL commanders. I'm like, dude, I'm 51 years old. I'm in the best shape of my life. Like, this is easy for me now. It's not complicated. This is how I eat. This is how I move. This is how I sleep. How are you not? And again, I'm 51. I'm not going to be, you know, at the same capacity I was at 21. But you know what I mean? I love looking around the room. I'm going to say this when I'm at the event. What are you doing, guys? Step up, both as a leader, but also to deal with that underlying any psychological challenges that might be there. The fastest way to deal with that is your nutrition and your sleep and making sure your own physiology is dialed in.
Because it is New Year's resolution time, and only 8% of those make it the 12 months. How does somebody kind of take those baby steps? I think people try to tackle too much. Like people are like, I'm going to do 8 million things to start the new year. How do you tackle those small baby steps to maybe get one thing knocked out?
This is the heart of my talk. So the heart of my talk is how to forge. It's all about forging anti-fragility and anti-fragile confidence. So anti-fragility, we define. Confidence, we will define as well, briefly right now. It means confidere, intense trust. So if you want to have intense trust in any relationship, starting with yourself, what do you need to do? You need to do what you say you will do, right? So if you say you're going to do certain things, you need to do them. But now it can't be the 8 million things. So the exercise I have people do is imagine you at your best in the past, right? What did you do? And then what did you not do? And literally, I will have our guys and women do this. Do and don't. Make it very, very simple. When you're at your best, what do you do? What do you not do? And then circle the number one thing that you know you need to start doing and the number one thing you know you need to stop doing. And paradoxically, it's the kryptonite. It's the stuff that you know you need to stop doing that will change your life the most. But then you just radically, ruthlessly, relentlessly simplify. And then it's process. I mean, again, any great coach is going to focus on the process. So let's simplify it, get that checklist going and let's go. And then the key though is the worse you feel, the more committed you are to what I call your protocol. That's what Phil Stutz taught me that became anti-fragile confidence. The worse you feel, the more committed you are to your protocol. That's how when life hits you, you don't break and go do all the stupid shit you do when you're not plugged in, vicious off the rail stuff, and then your life spirals out. When you get hit, the moment you get hit, you say, life's challenging me. I'm going to double down on my protocol. What do I do? What do I not do? And that version of you outperforms the version of you that's not every single time. And again, culturally, you got to bring that through your team. You got to bring that through your organization. And when you do, I worked with Marcus and Notre Dame day one of their preseason when they went to the national championships. And I told them that they're going to get hit. They did in the second game. But what do you do when you get hit? That's when you get an opportunity to forge your anti-fragile confidence, double down on your protocol, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
You reference your son playing chess and Arete, and I think your daughter does too. You know, for anybody that's trying to coach their kids out there, because we have a lot of parents that are members that are trying to coach their kids for the first time, what are some recommendations of nursing? Dan said it's that youth chess isn't much different than maybe the travel baseball scene.
Dude, we can share some stories on that. I want to be my kids when I grow up. is my joke with my wife. We wish we had ourselves as parents. My 8-year-old daughter, my 13-year-old son, he's quite good and he wants to be a grandmaster. It's his thing. It's his passion. And he's been at it for a few years and whatnot. My 8-year-old daughter just started playing like 4 months ago. She's a beast. So for me, it's all the obvious win or learn, but they get it. It's Carol Dweck's fixed versus growth mindset. Like that's been my number one thing. And there's a couple of philosopher's notes in particular I'll share with you on that. That's how I parent. So everything for me is, first of all, the ultimate game. The ultimate game is not chess. It's not baseball. The ultimate game is, and I ask my son this every time we go out to a chess tournament, what do you want in life? And he says, I want to be a good person and I want to be a grandmaster. Perfect, good order. How are you going to be a good person? Oh, I'm going to be wise, disciplined, loving, courageous. Rattles it off. Oh, cool. What are those virtues? And then we get to the little game, which is an opportunity to practice your overall philosophy. But in terms of the specific technique I use, first of all, they're not afraid of losing. So we're all about learning. And again, not the nonsense win or learn, a true win or learn. So after every single game that he plays, and in chess, you play like, you know, 5 to 7, 2-3 hour games, 2 or 3 a day over 3 or 4 days. So after every single game, and he's probably played about 250 tournament games now, I do the same exact thing, which I got from Lanny Basham, who's a gold medal winning rifle shooter. He says, after any performance, you first, 1, 2, 3, first, you celebrate what went well, always. You always start with a positive. And he has a book called Parenting Champions that I have a philosopher's note on, where he talks about this. First thing is, what was awesome? So what's awesome can range from, dude, you showed up, you played against a grandmaster. That's amazing. You know, yeah, you lost, but that's amazing, dude. Or you made this move that you're really proud of. You were in a position to win and then it slipped up. Whatever it is, find something awesome. Because we all want to go to the thing that wasn't good first. Don't. Focus on what's positive. If you want your kid to remain inspired and excited about it. 2, what specifically, if you can go back to that performance, what specifically would have you done differently? Was there a moment when you could have done something differently? And then 3, what specifically will you do differently next time? Right. And then what I've done with the kids is I've shown them how when we 1, 2, 3, it leads to a win. So for us, winning, you win or you learn, and learning is winning. Therefore, you win or you win. But I have taken that way off the bumper sticker. So, for example, my son, when he first played a chess tournament, and we have parallels in baseball, right? He accidentally touched a piece. His opponent told him he had to move it. And so he did, and he lost. He came out crying. I don't even know the rules of chess, dude. I'm like, I go talk to the tournament director. He's like, no, you can say adjust when that happens. And you don't need to move it. You just need to say adjust if you accidentally do it. Literally 2 tournaments later, same thing happens. A kid tells me, I have goosebumps right now. You have to move the piece. He says, no, I don't. They argue about it. He raises his hand. The tournament director says, no, he doesn't. So what happened is he won that game. He lost the other game. He learned something that affected the next game and he won. We've done that, dude, dozens of times. So they actually believe that they either win or they learn. And by learning, they win. Anyway, that's by far the number one thing. They have no fear of losing. They have no fear of making mistakes. We know that that's how they're going to learn. And I've been obnoxious in repeating that to my kids, such that they're parroting it back. But it's not like it's weird. With my son, he had to learn it. My daughter was listening and she's like viscerally gets that. So that's a long kind of monologue on what's worked for us.
Did you play much chess growing up?
Dude, I didn't even know what the pieces were called until college. You know what I mean?
Because here's why I asked, because I always get a lot of questions from parents and I'm like, you need to, whatever your child is passionate about, I don't care if it's sports, theater, music, you need to fan that passion for your child. And I think that's a great story because you knew nothing about chess. Your kids are into it, so you're fanning that flame for them and instilling that passion and cultivating that passion that they have for not what you want to do, what they want to do.
100%. And that was a deliberate design for us as parents, is find the thing that they naturally are drawn toward. And then when we found it, go all in to the extent they want to and then pace it properly. And again, that dynamic between chess parents and, I mean, The parallel with chess is I'm in a game. So I consider myself a middling chess player, but I'm better than 95% of people on chess.com, right? But I'm not good. My son can beat me blindfolded. right? So my son is insane, like really, really good. And he's playing against these other kids that are equally good. With respect, there's a dad in the thing, and you can watch the games. If you're a really good player, you can watch them if they're on the top boards. And then you can analyze them in chess.com to see if it's a good move or not, which is the only way I could tell you if it's a good move or not. Anyway, the kid comes in and the dad's giving him this lecture. I'm like, damn, this guy's good. You know, like, he must be a really good chess player, right? And I'm like, wow, you're a really good chess player. He's like, no, you know, he's like way worse than me. And I'm like, bro, thinking to myself, like, I didn't even know what to say about that. But like, and making his son feel like he didn't do well, you know? And I'm like, I think that challenge we have, you know, and stating the obvious, but when our egos become part of our kids' performance, it obviously gets toxic. But my thing with my kid is he's decided he's passionate about it. Now I'm going to go all in on it. And then the joke is I don't talk to him about chess at all, but I'm pretty good at the mental toughness side of things. And he's got a better pre-match protocol. Like him, a baseball coach, you know, you walk up to the batter's box, you better have a protocol. My kid's got what must be the most dialed protocol for every game.
Well, you've kind of taken that the car ride home approach. You hear that a lot with you baseball parents is don't talk about it in the car. You've kind of taken that with chess is you're not going to talk about chess.
No,
unless they want to.
No, I see. But the only reason you do that is if you're going to be a jerk. So my son, there's another book called 10 to 25, which is by Dave Yeager. And for any parent of a kid 10 to 25, read the book. You can check out the Philosopher's Note we have on it. It is the number one parenting book recommendation I would make. Dave Yeager is Carol Dweck's protege. Carol Dweck, of course, the growth mindset. So what 10 to 25-year-olds want is earned competence. They want to experience mastery in life, right? So then what he says, you need to have a mentor mindset. Now, if I'm a tyrant and I have high standards and low warmth, you don't want to talk about anything after the game because you're going to be a jerk, right? I can have high love and low standards, and then I'm coddling and I'm not winning either. What you want is high standards and high warmth. Then you get excited. Then it's a collaborative effort. I'm not playing the game, thank God, because I would not be good at this chess game. But then we can have fun unpacking it and going wherever he wants. And then my thing is supporting him in what he's told me is important. But that's why I'm excited about chess, is that he is earning competence in something that he will be able to take into every aspect of his life. That's why sports, that's why baseball in this context is valuable. And we can't forget that. The ultimate game is to build a child that is going to flourish and win in life. And then we use the sport as an opportunity to do that. But then we need to practice it. So what Carol Dweck says is every time you experience a challenge in your life, like if it's fixing the faucet in the kitchen or whatever, rub your hands together and say, I love hard things. I love challenges. Wow, that's great. And I did that, dude, obnoxiously. Such that my own experiences, when I'm running our business, I'm facing challenges all the time. I talk about them. I am a human being facing challenges and using that as an example. The other obvious thing I just want to say out loud, I have never once praised talent or his intelligence, not once, not once. And this is Carol Dweck. Do not praise talent or skill or intelligence, praise effort. Yep. So I'm obsessive about praising effort and hard work that leads to unlocking his potential. That's an obvious thing, but just want to make sure I said it while I was thinking about it. But dude, we talk about whatever he wants to talk about, but we talk about it all the time. To the extent we 1, 2, 3, we learn from it. And then we, you know, set the goal for the next thing. And then, you know, whatever life kind of unfolds.
You know, you've had some crossroads, and I think a lot of our coaches and listeners kind of go through those crossroads in life a little bit. How do you know when you need to pivot on something? Or do you know?
No, I mean, dude, this goes back to the metaphor of when the wind's blowing. So the only time that question even arises is life's hard. And again, whether it's you need to pivot on how you're approaching your energy, your work, or your love, we talk about the big three a lot with my work. So the first sign is that you need to slow down is that life's moving too fast. You're feeling overwhelmed. You're feeling uncentered. You're feeling ungrounded. And to me, you got to control the controllables. So I'm all about John Wooden. I'm a UCLA guy with Dan, right? What did he teach his basketball players? The best of his generation. Lou Alcindor, Bill Walton. They couldn't touch a basketball until they learned how to put on their socks. So for me, when the wind blows and life is hard, that's when I slow down I dial in my nutrition, man. I dial in my movement. I dial in my sleep. I reduce my tech inputs and I just get myself in a good spot. Because what I want to do is, the ultimate game is to connect to your best self. The Greeks called that, the Stoics called that your daimon, right? So you have a guiding spirit. The Romans called it your genius. In Roman times, everyone had a genius. It wasn't a genius. You had a genius, a guiding spirit. The Greeks called that your daimon. The diminutive of daimon is your demon. That's where the word demon comes from. Demon is the lower version of you. Your daimon is the best. So in moments like that, what I do is everything I possibly can to reconnect to my best self. To use a Christian Catholic metaphor on it, a Christian metaphor, Desmond Tutu once said that we're just these little light bulbs. Our job is to stay screwed in. There's something bigger than us coming through. In those moments of life where we feel a need to make a big decision, I believe our biggest job is to slow down, connect to something bigger than ourselves, call it God, call it whatever you want, through the practices. And then to me, these things are spiritual acts, man. I mean, to me, church is a 24-hour a day thing. How I'm eating, how I'm moving, how I'm sleeping, how I'm showing up with my kids, you know, that I'm journaling in the morning, thinking about these things before I allow inputs in, that I'm turning off TikTok, Netflix, doom scrolling. And I'm really asking myself these questions. That's how I approach those moments. And then your inner guide knows. Now, you may not be slowing down long enough to find out the answer to the question, but it knows.
Do you have any sleep hygiene tips?
Dude, sleep is a sport for me. So literally, sleep is a sport. The number one thing with sleep is you need to prioritize it. So if you are getting less than the recommended 7 to 8 hours of sleep a night, not time in bed, sleep, and a 90% efficiency is very good. So if you need 7 hours of sleep, you need to be at least in bed for 8 hours, right? I'm in bed for 9 to 10 hours a night. I prioritize sleep. That's my number one sleep hygiene tip, such that I get, last night was only 7.5 hours. It's in bed for 9 hours, but I was working. I was grinding on stuff. I was literally up for 1.5 hours. Perfect. I'm in bed. I still got my 7.5. Feel great. So the first sleep hygiene tip is prioritize it. And again, if you're carrying extra visceral fat around your waist, the typical American gut, know that that's the highest predictor of your morbidity. If your waist to height ratio isn't 0.5, you're at risk of dying. I share that in the context of sleep because your sleep is going to be what regulates your insulin more than anything else. So prioritize your sleep. Create a window of time where you can be in bed. And again, you know, the coaches in this community, especially the collegiate and pro, you got an even bigger challenge. But if you're not embodying your sleep, neither is your team. You look at the Dodgers, dude, they have two different planes, one for the equipment and the rest of the staff and one for the team. And they do that because sleep matters. They can prioritize the sleep patterns for their players. And those margins matter. The science is unequivocal. An extra 15, 30, 45, 60 minutes of sleep a night improves your performance on everything. The team that sleeps more will beat the team that doesn't sleep as much every time, every single time.
It's the glymphatic system. I mentioned this too when I go speak, the glymphatic system in your brain. If your players or coaches aren't getting enough sleep, those learning markers don't set in your brain. So then people wonder why they're not retaining any information at all.
Well, and why they're everything, dude. I mean, okay. The speed with which you're responding to any different inputs, et cetera. Your psychology, you're going to be less hopeful when you're sleep deprived. Your memory changes, dude. You can't remember the positive stuff. You just remember the negative stuff. And again, you know this, and your coaches that are paying attention know this, but then you got to implement it. Luke Donald, in that same press conference where he talked about anti-fragility, I'm all about marginal gains, the tiny little things. So right after he said the anti-fragile thing, he gave a case study talk on little things. So they came out weeks before to get time adapted, right? And then there was a little bit too much light, talk about sleep hygiene tips, coming into their room. So they taped the doors. And then this wasn't quite right. And that wasn't quite right. So if I was a coach of any baseball team, particularly the collegiate and professional levels, these little things on eating, moving, sleeping, you look at what these athletes eat. It's crazy, dude. I mean, the opportunities, marginal gains, and they're not even marginal on these basic, of course, everyone moves, but on the recovery and the fueling is huge. But anyway, I wear an eye mask. I wear earplugs. I have a little air purifier going in my room. I do everything I possibly can to to eke out gains on that, because there's nothing that's a bigger lever for me to show up consistently. And I go so hard that I need to train my recovery at least as well as I do my performance.
Do you have a strict feeding window?
Do I have a what?
A strict feeding window.
Yeah, I mean, I'll play with it a little bit. But yeah, I mean, I'm going to try to eat my last meal 4 hours before bed. I might flex it 2 to 3 hours. You know, sometimes I need a little bit more. But you know, through the glymphatic stuff, that eating right before you go to bed is a great way to destroy your deep sleep and all the other markers you want to improve. So yeah, I try to eat within like a 10-hour window or so, 10, 12-hour window. I don't go crazy on it. I find that I can be too narrow and then there's a little bit too much cortisol, but like that 10, 12-hour window, I find to be really nice. 8 on the shorter side for me.
How'd you get connected with Sean Casey, the mayor?
That's a good question. Brian Kane. Yeah. Kaner connected us. Yeah. So Brian Kane's another one of my favorite human beings on the planet. I know that he's a big part of your community and you two go way back. Kaner is who connected us.
I feel like there's just certain people out there that are really good at connecting people that need to be connected. And I feel like you're one of those people. Have you always been able to do that? Has that been a skill for you as far as being a connector?
I really appreciate you saying that. And one of the most ironic things is, you know, like networking events that you're supposed to go to. I have always hated those. Like literally since I was a young man, I'm like, okay, I'm supposed to go, but like, dude, this is just lame. Somehow, some way, I've been blessed to meet some really special people. And then, you know, for me, just there are certain connections. Like when I connected you to Sean, I'm like, do you guys know each other yet? Like, you need to know Sean. Like, he's just great. It's just kind of one of the things, you know, there's just an intuition of these people would be great together. I appreciate you saying that. Kaner's the same, you know, for me, he's been so generous and so great. And then it's interesting though, because it's a similar thing. If you ask the follow-on question of, well, how did you get good at that? It's the same thing as the mentorship. So if you want to have a great mentor, you need to be interesting enough and worthy enough to get that type of world-class mentor. Like you got to be at that level that merits that. And I've tried to be excellent, you know, and I've tried to be helpful, you know, in concrete ways and just to really master my craft. And I think that as we do that, opportunity to meet you through, you know, the combination of Brian and Dan, you know, it's like, okay, cool. Things happen and relationships form when we do what we're here to do.
I think the networking's in those organic moments. And I think that's what people appreciate about our convention is because it offers a lot of organic moments to network where it's not an actual networking event, even though it is. It does allow those individual conversations where you meet somebody. It does allow a lot of those organic interactions to happen.
Dude, your event, I joked with you, I'm like, 8,000 coaches?
That's
God, that's like we do our own, you know, much smaller events, and it's such a beautiful opportunity to come together and you bypass the whole networking thing because it's just really passionate human beings and coaches who are here to do their best. If I'm flying out to Columbus to be there in January, you know, I'm like, I'm all in. And to be in a room full of coaches that are shared values and shared intensity, like that's got to be many people's version of heaven, you know? That's awesome.
All right, everybody's got to answer this question. Do you have a fail forward moment? Something looking back now, maybe you thought was going to set you back, but helped you move forward? Could be personally, professionally. By the way, you just sent some out on LinkedIn and it's like right in that sweet spot talking about failure.
Did I?
Yes.
That's really funny. I try to stay off.
And the quote was pretty much talking about fail forward moments.
Yeah. I mean, dude, my life is just a series of them. I'll go back to what I can recall as one of the earliest ones, you know? So I went to UCLA undergrad, started my career doing consulting work, hated it, went to law school, knew I didn't really want to go, but it was better than what I was doing. Dropped out of law school. And I this is when I wanted to, you know, end my life. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I had all this energy and no idea, didn't want to go back and get another job. But the only thing I knew I wanted to do, so I was a failure at that moment. Everyone was telling me, at least stay a year, dude. You're at a great school and all this. And I couldn't even make it through a semester. You know, I'm like, no way. I just knew I wanted to work with kids and to coach a Little League baseball team. And out of that, I never could have predicted. And again, it sounds nice and warm and fuzzy. I wanted to end my life. Like, that's how bad it was. The only thing that gave me joy was to work with these 9 and 10 year old kids, neighbor kids, tears in my eyes. I'll go work with these kids and give back a little bit to the community. Out of that, I came up with an idea to create a platform called eTeams, which was one of the first platforms to ever bring these teams and leagues online. So by the time I would have, then we won a business plan competition at UCLA. I hired the CEO of Adidas to replace me. Dan Keller worked for me. He graduated, worked for me at that business. I hired the law firm I would have wanted to work for by the time I would have graduated from law school. So it was one of those, like, how do you like them apples moments, you know, just so funny, but never could have predicted it. But dude, I can give you a long list of me becoming that next best version of myself on the other side of the failure. And again, the wisdom obviously is you got to remember that while you're going through your next one, and you're never going to get to a point. This is Phil Stutz's number one wisdom. You're never going to be exonerated from pain, uncertainty, and hard work. And the story you're telling yourself that because you're a head coach of this team, you should no longer feel the things you felt when you were at these levels, that's your biggest source of suffering. That's what I tell the Naval Special Warfare guys. Dude, you're always going to have more pain, uncertainty, and hard work. You're going to have more opportunities to fail, but let's do it. Let's go through it with more grace and with more wisdom and discipline and love and courage. Remembering that those moments where you grew the most came on the other side of your biggest challenges. We call them hero bars. And then eat those while you're going through your next challenge without shaming yourself about why you shouldn't have to go through it again.
I just think successful people have a way of reframing all of that, because what you think you want, sometimes you look up 12 months from now, it's probably better than what you thought it was going to be or what you were hoping for at that point.
So Ray Dalio, one of the wealthiest, most influential people in the world, yep, he has a success formula, 5 steps. The first step is you have a big vision and dream. The second step is you fail. And then you learn, and then you create a new process, then you create a new dream, then you fail again, and you evolve up. But he's so embodies that, and he so loves making mistakes. He calls it a mistake learner's high. And this is what I'm frankly most proud of with my kids, that I've been able to help them understand. They get excited about, literally, that no one likes to lose, and there'll be a little bit of emotion there, but they quickly know that that's how they're going to get better. And the willingness to go through that as fast as they can, to lose your fear of losing is Hikaru, who's one of the top chess streamers. Literally, my kids told me, he just told him last week, you got to lose the fear of losing. Goosebumps. 8 and 13 year old pair, you know, yeah, that's what we've been talking about for years. So I think when we can really, really get that, and then remember that in the moment we're going through it, it's easy for me to say it to you, you to say it back to me. But what happens when I experience it and you experience it? Do we remember that? And are we able to, for me, double down on the protocol, use it to get stronger, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, you've been in those rooms with elite organizations and highly competitive humans. How do you get all of them to buy into something that's larger than themselves and not focus on themselves individually at times?
Dude, I find that group to be the most coachable.
It's crazy.
The thing that I have learned from, and it gives me tears in my eyes, dude, like, the thing that I've learned the most being in those rooms is there's their humility. I've never met more coachable human beings who are committed to something bigger than themselves. The military, it's like that is what they do. They've sacrificed everything. They're willing to sacrifice their life. And that is so humbling for me. I mean, again, you go, and you know this, you go meet any military officer of any caliber, they're the most humble person you know. Self-effacing, never going to take credit for anything. It's changed me. It's made me a better person. And then the Marcus Freemans of the world and the Lukes and the Rorys, like, these guys are the best or the most coachable. It's really, really been a beautiful thing to see, you know, and to be able to have so much confidence that you know you're not perfect, you know you're never going to be perfect, and you're just so excited to close the gap, and you're so hungry to learn the next thing that might be the thing that unlocks your next potential. That's I've gotten way more out of, and everyone says this, but I've gotten way more out of my work there. And then to see Justin Rose, dude, grinding on the practice tee after a round, like, man, certain images are just etched in my mind. You know what I mean? That's what excellence looks like. And then for me, it's how do I show up with that in my energy, in my work, in my love, in every aspect of my life, moment to moment to moment, in service to something bigger than myself. But let me actually ask the answer the question more directly. The way that I put it up, and I'm going to do this for you in January. I've got a series of slides. No one knows what the word hero means. Nobody. And I ask everybody, and sorry, spoiler alert for people that will be there in January. You can raise your hand when I say, does anyone know what the word hero means? You'll know the answer. The word hero means protector. It doesn't mean killer of bad guys, tough guy, or anything like that. When they came up with the word for hero, it meant protector. There's a victim that complains about life and a hero that goes and does something about it. So what I do is I teach people that they need to live for something bigger than themselves. That's what it means to be heroic. The hero's secret weapon is love. You have that strength for two because you're committed to someone and something bigger than yourself. That's what great teams have. And again, that brotherhood, that sense of commitment to something bigger than ourselves, whether it's our kids, our team, our community, the world, et cetera. That's it. That is the hero's secret weapon. And then when life's hard, you're always going to work harder for people you love, you know what I mean? Even more than for yourselves. And just reminding people of that. Anyone who has achieved any level of success knows that's true. They just need to remember it, more and more often.
Any other resources for coaches they need to dive into? They're listening in.
Again, it sounds self-interested, but I'm excited to share philosophers.
Yeah,
now.
I am too.
I mean, the thing that I get, this is how Luke found me. It's how I met Marcus through a general, this is what they do. Busy human beings who don't have time to read the books they want to read. I read them for you. I pull out the big ideas and then they listen to them on the way to the stadium or the clubhouse or whatever. And they get ideas for that day's talks and stuff like that. The practical tool I would recommend is think about that number one thing. So anytime I find myself really wanting to go next level or finding myself a little bit less centered than I want to be, it's what's the number one thing I could start doing right now that would most change my life? And what's the number one thing I need to stop doing? I've done that certainly hundreds, probably thousands of times. And that's an everyday kind of thing. So that's the practical way to connect to your best self. That I think might be helpful.
What are some final thoughts before I let you go?
Thank you, man. I appreciate you. I'm thrilled that Dan connected us, and thank you, Brian, for Brian O'Connor. I keep on referencing when he held up the Arte book, and I just admire what you're doing, your team. It's been fun to connect with Kurt and excited to see you in January and feel honored to have an opportunity to share this wisdom with your community. And I'm just excited about what we can do in the future.
Thanks for your time, Brian. Appreciate you. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Ryan.
I was excited to record with Brian having read Arete. I would highly recommend you picking it up. Lots of great takeaways that you can implement immediately into your daily life. Shout out to Daniel Keller for making the connection. Pumped for Brian to speak in Columbus. I'm wishing everyone a great new year. Thanks again to John Litchfield, Zach Hale, and Matt West in the ABCA office for all the help on the podcast. Feel free to reach out to me via email, rbrownlee@abca.org, Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok, @coachb_ABCA. Direct message me via the MyBSA app. This is Ryan Brownlee signing off for the American Baseball Coaches Association. Thanks, and leave it better for those behind you. Keeps on turning.